Remaker's Mark Episode 12, The Shining. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Remaker's Mark. Today, we are going to be discussing the psychological horror movie classic, The Shining. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing tonight?
Splendid, thank you.
I just was sort of inhabited by Christopher Walken there. That was really weird. I'm happy to hear you doing splendidly.
Thank you.
It's not the first time.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. I try to have that happen as much as possible, actually.
His ghost haunts us all.
It's true. So true. Jeremy Nilsson, how are you doing tonight?
I am lovely this evening. Thank you.
Excellent. Good to hear. Lee Rodgers and Hammerstein, how are you this fine evening?
Fantastic.
Good, good. And Mark Josting, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good, good. Happy to hear it. My name is Kyle Delahunt, and I will be your host once again here at Remakers Mark. Before we move along, I want to thank our friends at Tipsy Pixels for their promotional consideration.
Tipsy Pixels is a monthly retro video game contest hosted by Nels Lenz of Huge Theater. It features drink specials from Tallgrass Brewing, and players can win prizes from Level Up Games, as well as free drinks and tickets to shows. The next event is October 17th as part of the Minneapolis Institute of Arts Third Thursday festivities. To find out more information about Tipsy Pixels, head to tipsypixels.com or follow them on Twitter at tipsypixels.
All right, thanks again to Tipsy Pixels. So now let's move on to The Shining. Andy, do you want to talk a little bit about The Shining and about our history with it?
The Shining is a 1980 psychological horror film produced and directed by Stanley Kubrick. Based on the Stephen King novel of the same name, it tells the story of a writer, Jack Torrance, and his family who take on the caretaking duties at an isolated hotel. His young son, Danny, possesses psychic abilities and is able to see things from the past and future, a power called The Shining. Soon after settling in, the family is trapped in the hotel by a snowstorm, and Jack gradually descends into madness.
Very good. That's a compelling history, madness. A compelling summary, I would say. Madness. I assume you said madness like a normal person does, and then the shining abilities made it come out like a whisper. Am I correct?
We should re-record that, and when I say the shining and then madness, I should just pause and just have Mark say it in that voice instead.
I like it. I'll modulate the voice ever so slightly, too. Mm-hmm. We'll make that work. Yay, the power of post-processing. Very good. And what about the history, Andy?
Well, my history goes back a long way with this movie to about last Wednesday when I watched it for the first time.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm not that familiar. I don't have, as I said, I thought I didn't have that much of a familiarity with Stephen King works. Turns out I do to a certain extent via movies, but yeah, this is one that I had wanted to see. I'm not a big horror suspense movie fan. I'm kind of a wimp when it comes to movies like that.
This is true.
It's no lie. I'm just kind of a big wuss. So yeah, I watched it for the first time last week and I thoroughly enjoyed it, but I was thoroughly creeped out too.
Yeah, it was fun. Andy and I were texting back and forth while he was watching it, and I had watched it, I think, a couple nights prior. And so it was fun seeing when he checked in and, you know, talking about saying, you know, oh, scat man,
you know. Yeah. Oh, scat man.
It was fun. And then
why do the good ones have to go?
Yeah, yeah. Spoiler alert, FYI, BTW, et cetera, et cetera. And Jer, how about you? What's your history with this guy?
Well, probably the opposite of Andy. I've seen The Shining probably more than just about any horror movie. And I'm a big Stanley Kubrick fan at the same time. So that's probably where it originally came from. But in recent history, have really dove into the movie for other purposes and watched a lot of documentaries and a couple different documentaries, read quite a few articles on it, and have learned a lot of what could potentially be the hidden meaning of The Shining, or one of the dozens of hidden meanings in The Shining. So it's one of my favorite movies ever. And I probably watch it at least once a year. And in recent years, I've watched it every couple of months just for research purposes, because I've given some presentations on some of the conspiracy theories and other random oddities that seem to be attached with this movie and Kubrick's directing. So I may have a lot to say. I'm going to try to shut up as much as I can, but I absolutely love this movie. And everything from soundtrack to how it's acted, to how it's filmed most especially. And so it's just such a beautifully creepy movie. And when Andy texted me after he had seen it the first time, and his first comment was, "That creeped me the hell out." And I was like, yes, yep. Yes, it does. More so yep. than any other scary movie that I've seen, or maybe, you know, within the three or four, it's just plain creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, indeed. And Mark, we didn't get to ask about this because you were under the weather when we did our pre-production, but do you have any particular history with this film at all?
Like a lot of movies, this is one that I had seen parts of throughout, you know, channel surfing as a teenager. It always struck me, though, that just the Kubrickness of it, that
yep.
it's just rich with these awesome close-ups of horrified expressions and awkward long shots that just keep you hanging on them for what seems like an eternity. I'm a big fan of cinematography and direction, and this is one of the classics.
This is ripe with it.
This movie has a whole lot of both of those things, and we're definitely going to touch on that in part two. That's a big part of what we're going to talk about, is the Kubrickness-osity of it. So, for sure. All right, cool. Well, thanks for that, gents. So now, in part one, as usual, we're going to move on to casting the movie, or in this case, recasting the movie. So we're going to talk about four major roles here that we're going to recast, and then we're also going to do something that we've never done before, which is we're going to recast, if you will, the director, or we're going to choose a director today that we would want to make this movie. Because Stanley Kubrick was such a presence in the first, or in the original movie, we want to see who we think would be the best director for this and why. So starting off is Dick Halloran. Andy, tell us about Dick Halloran.
Dick Halloran is the cook at the Overlook Hotel, and he also possesses the gift of the shine. He explains the shine to young Danny in a sort of creepy way. He is also the one to sense that things have gone awry at the hotel during the off-season, and he comes back to save the day. Or at least that's his intention.
Dr. Halloran, are you scared of this place?
No. Nothing here. It's just that, you know, some places are like people. Some shine and some don't. I guess you could say the Overlook Hotel here has something about it that's like shining.
Is there something bad here?
Well, you know, Doc, when something happens, it can leave a trace of itself behind. Say, like, if someone burns toast, well, maybe things that happen leave other kind of traces behind. Not things that anyone can notice, but things that people who shine can see.
Dick Halloran is originally played by Scatman Crothers, and...
What a great name.
Oh my gosh, he was... I think he may have been my favorite character from this movie. One of the top two.
out of four.
Out of about six. His character, you know, kind of without going too much into the Kubrickness already, he's initially, I couldn't tell, like, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Or is he just kind of a weird, creepy guy when it comes to kids? Or what? And he's kind of, I don't know, a little all of the above, but in the end, he turns out to be a good guy, but he's still, even for such a relatively minor character, he's still very fleshed out and very interesting and not a throwaway character by any means at all. And I loved that. My pick for this one is it is probably going to require some rewrite of the character a little, I think mostly due to age. I picked Bill Cosby for this one.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't pick Bill Cosby because I wanted this character to be funny, because I wouldn't want to change that aspect of it at all. I think that Bill Cosby could play it a little bit creepy like Scatman Crothers did. Not creepy, that's not the right term, but dramatically.
Somberish?
Yeah. And I base a lot of that on actually a lot of the old stand-up comedy routines that Bill Cosby would do when he was younger that were really storytelling sessions, which are brilliant. If you've never watched any of those things, I highly recommend you look them up, because he's not a comedian in terms of telling one-liners. He tells stories, and they're brilliant. But he really connects. He really is just a very clear way of getting his point across. I'm rambling to the point of saying that I think that he would be very good Like in a scene specifically where he's explaining The Shine to Danny. But Bill Cosby's a pretty, he's older now than Scatman Crothers was in this movie. So whether he would be realistic as the head cook for a, you know, what appears to be a large and very busy hotel during the peak season, I don't know if that would work. So we may have to find a different role for him or something like that. But I think DeCalloran's role as the cook is a minor facet of his character. So it's not like it, you know, we need to see him julienning fries and things like that, you know, as part of the character.
It would be interesting. Like I could see them, if you wanted to go that age, I think it would be interesting to address that directly, not in like, I'm an old man, Danny, or I'm one season away from retirement or whatever, but like we could do something like, I was meant to be here, or I'm not meant to be anywhere else. So like tie him immediately into the mythology of that location. And then as you discover that he has the shine, like you see why he can't leave, or you see that connection immediately. Yeah. Like that could be potentially really, really powerful and have and add a whole a layer upon his ability aside from just being able to shine. But you could see him like not feeling like he can leave, like maybe he is beholden to the location or something like that,
which is really what I intended the whole time. So thanks, Kyle, for clarifying.
Sure thing. You can PayPal me later. It'll work
exactly
out.
No, actually I like that idea because it would be interesting to kind of put him, if Jack's character is beholden to the area in one sense, if Dick Halloran's character was beholden in another sense. So they're almost two sides of the same coin or something like that. That would be very interesting to tie it in that way. I like that idea. I'm going to go with that idea.
All right. You can have it for a low, low price of we'll figure it out. It's all yours.
Jer, who did you pick for Dick Halloran?
Well, I went, this is probably just kind of a throwaway pick in some respects, because every time I watch The Shining and I see Scatman Crothers, I associate him with Delroy Lindo because they look alike and they kind of have a similar vocal cadence. And so every time I see it, I think, it could be Delroy Lindo. And so I picked Delroy Lindo.
good technique. I appreciate that. I think I look like Delroy Lindo. I'm going to go with that.
But in all honesty, he's a great a dramatic actor. He has played quite a few sort of minor roles, but plays them very passionately, is probably not the right word, but with a lot of intensity. And I think that he could play that sort of not quite mentor role, but in the scope of The Shining, he really kind of is almost the narrator without being there for most of the events. But
yeah,
when it comes down to this story, he's really the only person that isn't affected by what's happening. He kind of, when he's there at the beginning, he kind of introduces everything and sort of showing us and showing the characters around, and then he leaves and then he comes back at the end for, you know, once everything's broken down. So he's really our witness, or in a storytelling sense, that what they would call the reliable narrator, because there really isn't one beyond him. So I think he does play a pretty important part in the movie. And so I think that Delroy Lindo, Sahara's own Delroy Lindo, could play.
Nice word. Could God play forbid that really you well. Go one episode without
I
Sahara.
Know,
Yeah, it's, you know, it's, you talk about the reliable narrator, but he's like, he's as close to a hero as we have too at the same time. Like, yeah, you know, everybody else is in peril, so there's not a hero per se, and he's close, and then that doesn't work out very well.
Right. No, and honestly, he's really a very important part of that story.
Very much.
Or at least the movie version of it. So an actor with some good dramatic chops and somebody that's going to be able to come in and I don't like to use this device, but there's a lot of times in horror movies now where you'll pull in more of a bigger name actor so that the audience feels comfortable with them and think, oh, they're going to be fine. They're famous. the director's not going to kill them. And then bam, they, you know, get an axe in the chest or whatever.
Thank you, Alfred Hitchcock, for that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. So. Yep. Good tie back for sure. Yep. Good one.
So that's my pick. I didn't only pick it because they looked alike. So that moves us to Kyle.
Yeah. So I wanted to have Someone that was as creepy as Scatman Crothers was, like, just kind of like he walked a little bit funny, and he just had like, he was slightly unsettling, but you wanted to be comfortable with him at the same time. Like, it's interesting how much they use Dick Halloran as like a exposition character too. Like, the conversation that he has with Danny about The Shining basically explains like a huge part of, I mean, in a 4 or 5 minute conversation, it basically like describes what, you know, hundreds of pages of the book did, basically, like the kind of the supernatural aspect and his ability and the fact that he has some too, like, you know, buildings are just like people, some shine, some don't. I mean, that line on its own just like completely encapsulated so much of the plot, and it, they relied upon him to deliver that, and it could have felt forced, but it really didn't. So I wanted somebody that could carry that type of conversation and make it feel natural, make it seem sort of normal, but yet not normal, as normal as that type of conversation can be, but abnormal because of the content. And I wanted somebody that again was just a little bit off. And so I went with Forrest Whitaker. I can just sort of imagine him staring at Danny, and Danny kind of looking at him like, oh, where do I look? Where do I stare? Okay, what's going on? Who's this guy? You know, like creepy at first, but then at the same time, as you become comfortable with him, he has a very comforting tone. He has a very comforting presence. You know, somebody that can play everything from, you know, he's in this new movie, The Butler, to Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. Right. I mean, like he can be anything and everything in terms of acting, from like big presence to very soft presence. And I think this role can capture both of those. So, you know, I really think that he would do a good job of making you feel ill at ease until you need to feel at ease, and then you will totally do so. And you'll really feel for him when he's like making this journey back to try to save the day and ultimately not doing so.
And one of the absurd, I like that pick. Forrest Whitaker is a very underrated actor, I think.
Thanks.
One of the absurd things about the character of now I'm thinking just Scatman Crothers. One of the absurd things about the role that he plays is he's sort of the grandfatherly figure to Danny and his mentor, but at the same time, you just like, I don't think I want to trust him very much. Like, hey, I wouldn't leave them alone or listen to him too much, because he's kind of crazy maybe, and talking about houses that feel. And so it's the simultaneous, like, He's the best guy in the movie. I mean, not the good guy, but he's the only redeeming person here, really. And at the same time, you're just like, he's oogie.
Yeah.
And I think Forrest Whitaker could pull off that sort of duality.
Yeah, he'd have some good oogie.
Oogie.
Indeed. He does oogie well. Mark, how about you? Who did you pick for Dick Halloran?
Well, my pick for Dick would be the one that does not look like the others, because he's Gary Oldman.
Nice.
Bam.
Oh my God. That should be like an Oscar, you know, if ever he's introducing something, if ever he's doing a presentation. Now the person who looks like no other, because he's Gary Oldman. Gary Oldman.
I didn't feel any particular need to cast a black man for this role.
Agreed.
I think the reason was that it struck me right away that Halloran is an Irish name, but
Black Irish. Come on,
that's not what that means.
Quiet you.
the thing that my focus point for recasting this role was really just one little scene, and it's that scene where Halloran is in Florida, and we can see that through The Shining, he's realizing what's happening at the Overlook Hotel, and he slowly gets this look on his face, and the camera slowly pans in on him.
Creeps me out.
Oh, yep. I love that shot. I love that sequence.
He doesn't blink.
I know, he doesn't blink.
And the pan back and forth to Danny, like shaky and kind of like foaming at the mouth. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think in other contexts that would probably be overacting, but, well, thank you, Stanley Kubrick. And I think overacting in combination with a great director, well, that just says Gary Oldman to me.
Indeed.
I think that's right on. Yep. There was a piece on Vulture today about, I think it was 20 different Gary Oldman accents in 60 seconds. And it was astounding. It was like Sid and Nancy, The Fifth Element, The Professional, The Dark Knight. I mean, it was just like everything, like a couple like Cockney accents, a full on Irish. Like it was crazy. Dracula, Coppola Dracula. So yeah, I mean, the dude can do anything.
Yes.
Absolutely anything. Yep.
So yeah, I wanted to go for that, seriously creeped out expression, and yeah, that's where I landed. Gary Oldman.
One of the things I love about that scene that you're talking about, if you look at the scene, he's in the most bizarre little motel room or wherever the heck he is. Like, there's a naked girl painting on the wall, and he's just like, it's just so Kubrickian absurd. Like, what is going on? Where is he?
I imagine him coming into the hotel and there being like, do you want your room, Dick? And he's like, yep.
The usual.
Like, they hang up the art for him. Like, he doesn't have a home in Florida, but he just stays at this hotel. And he's like, you know, I would just like some naked lady art. And they're like, all right.
And so they pull down the naked lady, like, roller shades.
Yeah, it just, the paintings turn around. Like, one side is just still life and one side is naked lady. yeah, it's just so absurd. Like, the first time you're kind of like disarmed, like, wait, what? Hold on, what's going on here? But yet you're not taken out of the mood somehow. Amazingly, you're not. But yeah.
Well, speaking of naked ladies, Lee.
Nice segue.
Thank you.
Brilliant.
I don't know where that came from, but
just you know, Lee, you know.
Yeah. Well, my pick for Dick Halloran was, like Mark, I didn't feel a need to make sure that the character was black. I almost thought that Scatman Crothers was a little too warm, and I thought he wasn't quite creepy enough, oddly enough. So I wanted to find someone who was a little bit more mysterious, and I went with Giovanni Ribisi, who has been in a ton of stuff. He's got a very long resume, mostly supporting roles, but one of the more memorable roles that I liked him in was Saving Private Ryan. Mm-hmm. He played a medic who...
Wade.
Medic Wade. And he's... You can kind of tell that, you know, cracks are forming in his psyche from being in combat too much. And I think that this character needs that. I need to see that with the character of Dick Halloran. I'd want him to be just a little bit more maybe off kilter that way.
That's a good pick.
Yeah, I like that. I do.
Thank
I do.
You. Yep.
That's agreed. A good one. He's maybe a little young, but not too bad.
He's almost 40.
Yeah, that's true. He always looks so young.
He could scruff him up a little bit. His death scene in Saving Private Ryan, spoiler, was one of the most, I think, touching isn't a strong enough word. I think it was wrenching to watch that death scene emotionally, because it was his portrayal of it and the way that he projected the emotions that were running through his brain as he knew that he was dying. It was astounding.
Yeah. And he's, the most likable guy gets killed and they're all standing around and, you know, they all know that they can't do anything for him.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a terrific scene.
Yeah,
but that is my pick, Giovanni Ribisi.
I don't know if that's necessarily inspiration for this, but it's a good callback for sure.
Yeah,
you want his axe on the chest to be especially meaningful, even more so.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, let's recap. for Dick Halloran, Andy chose Bill Cosby, Jer chose Delroy Lindo, I chose Forrest Whitaker, Mark chose Gary Oldman, and Lee chose Giovanni Ribisi. So up next is the role of Danny Torrance. Danny is a hard one. We kind of bounced some emails back and forth today with some general frustrations about how hard it was to cast a young actor. And so we contemplated maybe not casting it, maybe, you know, picking from any era, child actor, something like that. But I think we were all able to do it. It's probably not quite the same as in the movie, but we did recast Danny. So I have a feeling we won't be quite so flowery in our descriptions here. But Mark, do you want to tell us a little bit about Danny, and then let me know who you cast?
Sure do. Danny is the son of Jack and Wendy Torrance, a small boy who, for some reason, has a smaller boy living in his mouth. He has a certain shine about him, and so is the one member of the family that is able to foresee that the Overlook Hotel will kill them. My pick for Danny Torrance is Asa Butterfield. To piggyback our disclaimer about kid actors, I mean, yeah, really tough to recast children just because, I mean, the feature roles for kids in Hollywood are uncommon, and the actors just don't stay kids for very long. That being said, I didn't feel a need to keep Danny as that young of a role. I mean, in the original film, he's what, like 6 or 7, and
yep,
it's so tough to find an actor that young. I mean, especially since this is a show where we're trying to get a group of actors, we're all going to cast the same kid. We don't want that. Variety being the spice of life and all.
Indeed.
And I think that making Danny a little bit older is really, really going to work, because you get into preteen or maybe even teenage years, and you know, it's a pretty critical time for a kid, and it's a time when, you know, frankly, all kids are basket cases. For them to be to have psychic powers and to be chased by ghosts is I think going to lend a little bit more heft to the story. So Asa Butterfield is my pick, and you would know him probably from Hugo. He played Hugo, but he was also in some other roles like Nanny McPhee Returns and The Wolfman and the TV series Merlin.
Boy in the Striped Pajamas is where I saw him, and he is fantastic in that.
Absolutely,
my key for him was Hugo, and I just saw a lot of depth and subtlety in his acting, which. That's why I really like him. I mean, he's 16 now, but he still looks very young.
Yeah, he does.
I think he could do the moody young teenager pretty well, and it would work in the story for me.
Yeah, one of the things that it didn't bug me about the original performance, but the whole like finger Tony guy, kind of like
background.
It almost took me out of it. Yeah, it was interesting, and it ultimately paid off when he you know writes on the door and lipstick and then does that, or like when Danny like goes away for a while and it's just Tony. I think that's an interesting payoff, but I think that could be that much more potent when you don't have this sort of like gimmicky finger guy or the guy that lives in my mouth. Like it's true schizophrenia seeming, or it's something like that, you know, something where it's like grounded a little bit more in reality that would make it that much more frightening, because it's like with Danny, you can't quite tell if it's just like an imaginary friend. Whereas if it truly comes across as mental illness or seemingly therein, that's a whole different story. And imagine having a teenager of your own who is going through that. And again, like you said, trying to grow up with all this challenging and puberty and just figuring out what the hell's going on in life in general, and then having to cope with that and being removed from your school to go live in this hotel. I mean, you know, all these different things. So yeah, I think that's a good choice. I very much support that.
Thanks. I would also point out that, you know, as all comic book nerds know, superpowers hit you at puberty.
True. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
What about baby geniuses, though?
It's not a superpower.
Dang it.
Unless they're talking babies, which are super.
So John Travolta.
Then they work for E-Trade.
Oh, right, right.
Yes, E-Trade, exactly. Oh, that's our sponsor to this week.
One of the one of the things that I like about the Danny character in the movie is that, kind of what you guys were hinting at, we don't really know quite what's going on with him. Is the Shining making him act so erratically and weird? Does he have some kind of illness? There's sort of hints of that when Wendy talks about, you know, getting into a new environment and working on things at the beginning of the movie. Just sort of these offhanded remarks about that, and you know, getting him out of the school and whatever. And you know, you've got this Tony, the little boy that lives in his mouth, and like you just don't really know. Is this all based on this power? Are there ghosts that are sort of manipulating him? Is he just chemically imbalanced? Is he just a kid with an imaginary friend? Like, there's just so much going on, and none of it's ever explained. And I think that's what makes him so interesting and so difficult to play at the same time. Like, you don't want to give away any of it, because none of it is for sure what's going on.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to vary between something that he seemingly can't control because it's something that's wrong with his brain, or him being a medium for the spirit of the hotel. You know what I mean? Like, kind of vacillating between those two. That would be really interesting.
That's what I'd like to see, is that, the psychic power is communicating with the spirits of the hotel. I think it could be really scary.
Right on.
All right, so let's move on to Lee.
Thanks. Well, like you, Mark, I went with someone who is a little bit older. I don't think that there's anything in the story that, you know, absolutely says that Danny has to be a little kid. So I think my actor is roughly 12 or 13 right now. And I went with Preston Bailey, who I know most notably from Dexter. He played Rita's son. And, he's a very decent actor. He can really, handle himself with a bunch of adults. And I think he would be great for this role, just in that age range where, you know, you're starting to go through your first, changes and you're not quite sure of yourself. I think he could play that awkwardness very well.
Nice.
And, this is not a barometer for this, but he was also in one episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia as young Mac. So if anybody needs a reference. Yeah.
It's never a bad thing.
No.
And he looks like he was in The Crazies as well. And one of the things that informed my choice was that he's already done challenging film work in that regard, like kind of intense, scary, because like getting somebody that can do that well, I think is as hard as someone that has true talent. So I think you can have someone that is a really excellent actor, but then doesn't fit well in the environs in which he's working, like the kind of like Jake Lloyd syndrome, if you will. Like, I think Jake Lloyd was a great actor, but I don't think, well, he was a fine actor, but he wasn't great. But like put in amongst a blue screen and he didn't do well. Like, it just wasn't a place where he could thrive or really do well. Whereas somebody that has worked in scary films, or, you know, is comfortable doing that and can really bring that out in him, I think would be good. So
so that's my pick, and I believe Andy's next.
And here we have our first double pick of the night. I also picked Asa Butterfield.
You picked Jake Lloyd, didn't you? Oh, okay.
That's actually interesting. I wonder how old Jake Lloyd is now. Well, let's see here.
It looks like his last thing was 1982.
Jake Lloyd, what? I think you're looking at the wrong
Jake. Christopher Lloyd.
Danny Lloyd.
Oh, Danny Lloyd. Oh, wait, are they related? Weird.
That would be weird. Yeah, Danny Lloyd. That'd be something. Originally, only just did this movie and one other thing. I picked Asa Butterfield. Not going to lie, I don't know a lot of actors that would fit the age of the original character. And I like Asa Butterfield. On a side note for him, he's starring as Ender in the upcoming Ender's Game feature film, which I'm very excited about.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right.
So I was thinking, okay, so I like him as an actor. He's young. He very much looks young. How could we change the character to match the actor? Because it would look not necessarily scary creepy, but just weird creepy if he was riding around in a big wheel through the hotel.
Razor scooter.
Yeah, oh, man, I didn't think about losing the big wheel scenes with the older. Damn.
I know. See, so that's
hard.
Razor scooter, not a bad idea. Or those little wheelie shoes, you know, like, you know, kids still do those. Kids still do those things these days.
It'd be great. The wheelie shoes, like he's going down and then he just face plants when he hits the carpet.
does the Family Guy.
Yep.
So anyway, so if we were to have the character be closer to junior high age or middle school age, how would that look different? How would, I think part of the relationship between Dick Halloran and Danny Torrance is a little bit like, for me, at least when I was watching this, Danny seems so young and kind of overwhelmed, not really, but just kind of, he naturally looked like that little kid. Like when little kids that age meet grownups, they just kind of stare at them. When their parents are always like, say hi, and they never do. They just stare and then run away or something like that. So that made sense when he was just kind of, he didn't say anything. It would be weird if there was an older kid that would just stare, unless that was part of his character. Like he didn't relate well, like, you know, presented it as maybe he was on the spectrum of autism disorders or something like that. Or maybe that's what the parents would think. And then turns out, no, he's actually got this weird paranormal thing going on. I don't know. Those are my ideas. But anyway, Asa Butterfield was the actor that I chose.
I approve.
It's a good one. I totally forgot that he was doing Ender's Game.
Yeah,
so I'm excited about that one. The minds of people much, much bigger going forward.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, Jer, who you got?
Yes, sir. I chose somebody that I remembered from a previous horror movie that had been done a few years ago. But then the more that I looked into it, I think that he would still do a fantastic job. I chose Seamus Davy Fitzpatrick. Seamus Davy Fitzpatrick.
he's German, right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Japanese.
Actually, Filipino.
Oh, got it. Nice.
Scotch-Irish.
I remember him from the remake of The Omen, where he played Damien. And if you look at the pictures of him as Damien, it's the pictures themselves just sort of creep you out. But then he also was Roosevelt in Moonrise Kingdom last year. I think that most of us
Is that the main male character?
No.
He was still a kid.
Yeah, but the one who runs away, that kid?
He's young. He's younger.
I don't remember.
He plays the giant robot.
Carry on. Yeah, sorry. Sorry to hijack.
Not the main boy in that one.
Okay.
He's not the main character, no. But he's one of the he's got a pretty major role in it.
Okay.
If you look at him, I mean, you look at him as Damien back in 2006 or whatever that was, it's perfect. You look at him now and he could still, kind of like you guys, he could still play a younger looking kid. I think that he could probably pull off like a 9 or 10. I think he's 13 or 14 now. And I think he could play down to about a 10-year-old. Getting lower than that would be a little bit of a stretch. But he's got the horror movie chops with The Omen. I think that he's a really good from Moonrise Kingdom and from The Omen, and he's been in several other things that I haven't seen. Everybody's Fine, Before Midnight was his most recent one, which I haven't seen either of those two. But and then he also played Austin Kittredge in Northern Borders, which hello anybody?
No, I don't know that one.
Sorry.
He was basically the main character in that one. So, excellent kid actor or child actor, whatever's appropriate, who's got the pedigree to do horror well.
I dig it. Yeah, man, his picture on IMDb, it's like, I think it's about The Omen era would be my guess.
Yeah, it's probably 2006.
He has some scary eyes, man.
He looks tired. Like
crazy, crazy blue. Yeah, yep. Yeah, perpetually strung ass. Out for an 8-year-old.
Yeah, seriously.
Here's the... never mind.
Remember, this is a podcast chair. Describe it to us.
You guys just wanted to hang out with me.
Two anyway. Words. Rhymes with snowball. Oh my God, that's a great podcast idea. Charades.
We should start a podcast where we play Dungeons and Dragons.
Awesome.
Dude. Man.
I totally rolled a 20.
I'm in.
Again.
I don't know if we have the bandwidth or hard drive space for that, because it could go on for days.
Anyway, Kyle, who is your pick for Little Danny Torrance?
For Wee Danny. I similarly did not pick a 5, 6, 7, whatever year old. I went with Ty Simpkins. Not exactly a household name, as many of these people are not. He has done what he's probably most well known for is that he was in Iron Man 3 this past summer. He's the kid that Tony Stark kind of runs into and sort of befriends, and like he helps Tony and Tony helps him out. But then he was also in the movie Insidious, which has a sequel coming out this year, which is the first one was like 3/4 of a really great horror movie and 1/4 of super WTF, like one.
Shock.
Yeah, it was like the last part was just really bad, but the first part of it was really good and I really enjoyed it, and he was especially good. And he's done like, you know, good drama too. He did Little Children with Kate Winslet and Patrick Wilson. So like he's done drama, he's done horror, and he's done action, so he's kind of got that pedigree, if you will. Like he can really do all of that, and he's just got a good look about him. Like he looks normal-ish, but I think he can look creepy too. Like the original poster from Insidious is basically him standing in front of what is seemingly like a sort of normal suburban neighborhood, but it's really dark and foreboding and kind of
creepy. He looks terrifying.
Yeah, and he was really good in that, and I think he's a good actor. In Iron Man 3, he almost stole the show from Robert Downey Jr. Like, it takes serious talent to, like, keep up with him, and he more than did that, which is pretty, pretty astounding. So, yeah, so Ty Simpkins was my choice.
I like it.
Thanks. All right, so for Danny Torrance, originally played by Danny Lloyd, Mark went with Asa Butterfield, Lee went with Preston Bailey, Andy also went with Asa Butterfield, Jer went with Seamus Davy Fitzpatrick, and I went with Ty Simpkins. Okay, so now we are moving on to Wendy Torrance. Jer, tell us about Wendy.
Wendy Torrance is Jack Torrance's wife. She is essentially the only female character in the whole movie. She initially is pretty excited for their move to the hotel for the winter. Again, like I said, hinting at problems from the school and pretty optimistic that this change of environment will be good for Danny and good for their family so that they can, quote unquote, work on things. But as the movie progresses, she slowly realizes that her husband in this confined space and this weird, creepy hotel has gone from troubled to depressed to straight up crazy to a little bit murdery, and there's trouble afoot.
Good use of murdery. I had that written somewhere else earlier today, and it made me quite happy.
Shelley Duvall plays this character and she is Shelley Duvall, but she plays it as about as wide-eyed frightened as you can possibly get in a person. Part of that is just Shelley Duvall has some enormous eyes. But she is perfect at just being bewildered and acting with her face, going from confused to nervous to frightened without saying a whole lot. And I don't want to say that damsel in distress defines this role because I don't think it does. She does fend for herself and she saves her and Danny, so to speak, in the end. But at the same time, she spends the majority of the movie watching her husband sink lower and lower into insanity, and eventually he comes a-knocking with his baseball bat.
We have the snowcat. If the weather breaks, we might just be able to get down the mountain and could call the Force Rangers first and then tell them that we're coming so that they could start searching for us in case we didn't make it. And if Jack won't come with us, I'll just have to tell him that we're going by ourselves. That's all there is to it.
Red Rock!
And I think that takes quite a bit of talent besides just being, you know, scared girl. So I went with Zoe Saldana.
Oh.
Hmm. She most recently is Uhura in the new Star Trek movies, the J.J. Mm-hmm. Abrams Star Trek movies.
Mm-hmm.
Also played in the Avatar movie, although you can take that however you want to. It was all with the CG.
She wore the heck out of some dots.
She was credited in the Avatar movie.
Mm-hmm. She is credited. She is credited, but
yeah, totally.
But it's all, I mean, it's all completely CG.
That was my joke. She's
credited.
Never mind.
We'll edit that out. It'll be okay.
I just hate jokes.
I don't get them. I just don't get them.
The other one that I remember her from is she kind of plays a fairly minor role in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, or the first one. She's sort of the deckhand. Her character from Avatar and her character from as Uhura, I think, gives a lot of strength to the role, but also you can kind of see that vulnerability and that fear at a lot of times, too, so... I think that's the two most important things for the role. It's just you don't want her to be a completely helpless little, you know, standing in the corner screaming, because she doesn't do that a lot. She does defend herself. She does protect her son, and, you know, is fighting for him and fighting for her family. But at the same time, she's just completely out of her league when she realizes that her husband has gone completely insane.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to see, she is a, like, it, you know, as Uhura Uhura. She's a very strong Uhura. You know, she like, you know, she's firing blasters. I mean, she's in the thick of things. You know, she's in love with Spock. I mean, it's like, it's much more than just sort of the comms person that it was in the original series in a big way. So I think there might be like some concern about her being, and again, this is not my saying this, but like too strong compared to the original role. You know, like, I don't think that Shelley Duvall was weak in this role, but I think that...
I kind of do.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard. I think she was weak, but I don't think... I don't know. I have a really hard time with how to label that. I think that's a fair label, but I don't think it's quite right. I think she's terrified. I think that's probably the best way. She's just freaked the F out, understandably.
Yeah, I think that she spends at least half the movie in essentially what is survival mode. She's just trying to get through this without her family intact. Mm-hmm.
She's fight or flight with no opportunity for flight, and she doesn't want to fight.
That's pretty good.
Well said.
There was a lot of discussion in the trivia for this movie that how Jack Nicholson said that she had the toughest acting job in the history of film or something like that. And that Stanley Kubrick was reported to be especially hard on Shelley Duvall throughout the filming.
Terrorized her.
Yeah. Which so people were saying, oh, that was intentional so that she was just kind of naturally strung out. But she also said that she had to carry, or they had to have bottles of water on the set because she was crying so much that she essentially ran out of tears. So like they had to apparently have some emergency hydration so she could cry it all out.
Wow.
That poor woman.
That's acting right
there.
She
must have aged significantly in that movie.
Yeah. You know, one thing that's interesting is I was surprised, and I would have never, ever, 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 ever have said this before, but until Jack really loses it, it's a fairly understated performance. Like, it's a little awkward, it's stilted, but it's not over the top. But then when it goes over the top, it's like way over the top. But like when it's just her being a mom, you know, like the scene especially where she's describing when Jack came home drunk and separated Danny's shoulder or sprained his shoulder or whatever it was, like that was a really, really, really well acted scene. Like she could have been any mom in that circumstance, and it was very balanced, and you could like feel her understanding of what she was saying and how like kind of wrong it was, but wanting to accept him. And she defends him, even though she knows she maybe shouldn't, but she's proud of him at the same time. You know, it's so like, there's a ton of information and a ton of emotion just in that one scene alone.
It was just one of those things, you know, purely an accident. My husband had been drinking and he came home about 3 hours late. So he wasn't exactly in the greatest mood that night. And, well, Danny had scattered some of his school papers all over the room, and my husband grabbed his arm, you know, to pull him away from him. It's just the sort of thing you do 100 times with a child, you know, in the park or in the streets. But on this particular occasion, my husband just used too much strength and he injured Danny's arm. Anyway, something good did come out of it all because he said, Wendy, I'm never going to touch another drop. And if I do, you can leave me. And he didn't. And he hasn't had any alcohol in 5 months.
And then, I mean, when you get into the horror aspect of the movie, then she just like, again, lets it fly, like literally cries out all her tears. But yeah, before that, I had never ever thought of that before because I just equate it with those grandiose, like, holy crap, you know, emotional scenes. But before that, it was a really quite understated performance, I thought.
Yeah, I would agree. She has quite a few scenes where she's talking with Jack or she's talking with other people one-on-one, and there's so much history with the things that she says. There's so much tied into it that she doesn't say, but it's still there, that I think just makes her, you just know that there's a whole weight and depth to that character and that person of Wendy Torrance, that she's holding a lot on her shoulders. And I think she does a really good job of portraying that in a very understated way.
Yeah. I don't think she all wants to be at that hotel. I think if she had her druthers, she would be back home with Danny in his comfortable space and their comfortable space. But she's willing to do that for the family, thinking that this is, like you said, kind of the saving grace, like the thing that can save their relationship or their marriage and families. So, yeah, yep. that's it's not an easy place to be, and she plays it well.
Cal, who did you pick?
Well, that being said, I didn't cast for subtlety at all. Here I go and compliment her on the understated aspect of her performance. And then I just went for the person who I thought could do the most grandiose over-emoting possible as an actress. And
you picked Ethel Merman, didn't you?
I did. Ethel Merman and Carol Channing's magical daughter. I went with Julianne Moore. Who can do that grandiose, like almost theater like overacting and that emoting. Like she can do anything, and she can be understated too. So I think she could do that really well, but I don't know of anybody who can quite do those huge sweeping gestures and emotions quite like Julianne Moore can. The things that I struggle with is she might be a little bit too old, but she can play younger than she is, I think. She's not old, but she's not young. So I think she would have to play a little bit younger than she is, but I think she can do that. I think she's extremely diverse that way. And I think she would have a little bit of a harder time being kind of that, like, every person, if you will. Like, Shelley Duvall she is not glamorous, whereas Julianne Moore, you know, does spreads for Clever Girl and what have you. So there's a little bit of a concern there, but I think the emotional aspect of it would be really top-notch with her, and I think she could do that well, and she could defend herself well, and I think the physicality of it would be excellent. So Julianne Moore is who I went with.
She is a very excellent physical actress, whether it be for a comedy role or for a serious role. I think that she controls herself in such a way that she acts with her whole body, and I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if she needs to, she can do with her face what it would take an entire a different actress her entire body and lines with. I mean, she could just with her face and her mouth, the way that she acts is astounding.
She went off the deep end in the best way in Boogie Nights.
Yep. So that's a good one. There was the one that Tom Ford directed with Colin Firth as well. Is it the Single Man? I'll have to check that, but I think so. And she was really good in that. She plays kind of a little bit older, like well-to-do person who doesn't have any friends except for Colin Firth. And, you know, like they have a past and she kind of wants to be with him, but wants to maintain independence. And she knows what he needs, which is not her specifically and not women specifically. So, you know, she has all of that complexity, which I think this role that we talked about has all that in that. So, yeah. Lee, how about you? Who did you go with?
Well, I wanted to find some people who were very, very normal and very conventional, but could also play, you know, that intensity that's needed, you know, like what Shelley Duvall did. I guess I didn't stop and appreciate her performance enough because it seemed so natural. I almost forgot that it was a performance. And that's how good she was at it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to find someone who could do that equally as well. And I went with Evangeline Lilly, who we know from Lost. She played Kate. I don't know a whole lot else of what she's been in, but Lost I thought was a really good barometer for this. Every character on that show had, you know, a really wide arc and went through a lot. So I thought she would be terrific as Wendy Torrance.
I was so close to picking her for Wendy. I had her written down. She was one of the first picks that I had when we decided on The Shining. And the reason I went off of her is that the same reason that Kyle didn't like my pick. her characters that she's played, especially her character on Lost, is so strong that it would be hard to see her in that vulnerable state, although she's about to play an elf, although who knows if that's going to be a strong bow and arrow wielding elf or a
according to the trailers it is, yeah.
The Hobbit, but
you mean a Christmas elf?
Or a Christmas elf, yeah, a dentist elf.
A Keebler elf.
But yeah, I I really had her down for up until today. I had her as my Wendy Torrance, and I like the pick a lot. But that was my one reservation.
There are plenty of moments on Lost, though, I think, when she's completely powerless.
Yeah.
And helpless, and she does go into survival mode a lot. Like, even in the first episode, there's that moment where they're running from whatever is making that noise that they don't know, and she completely flips out and hides. But I thought she was good for this one, so.
I like her an awful lot.
Yeah, I think she can do emotionally vulnerable really well. She does that, like, over the top, like, oh my God, what is happening to me? This, you know, we talk a lot about those scenes that we try to, like, paste our recasting choices into. And I think one of those, in this case for me, was the scene on the stairs where she's got the bat kind of, like, halfway up and she's, like, kind of trying to keep him away. And I would have a hard time. It doesn't mean that she would have to do that exactly how Shelley Duvall did it or they did it in the original, but I would have a hard time buying her not just beating the hell out of Jack Torrance in that moment, you know, just based on lineage. So it's unfortunate that she has had that, because I think she can be that emotionally vulnerable, but it's like knowing what came before and having that so emblazoned in the brain that would be harder. But I think she could do it. I totally think she could do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't think that character needs to be so helpless.
I just love that scene so much. Oh man, yeah. That's so great. Yep.
It would make for a very different movie if she just cold cocked him on the first swing and be like, oh, yeah, done.
Yep. Yep.
But I believe Mark's up next.
Indeed. And I'm definitely on the same page where I would, thinking about that exact scene where Wendy and Jack are on the stairs and she's waving the baseball bat around at him, it's drove me, well, batty. Just just how much. Sorry. Wah, wah. Oh, I'm so sorry. It made me crazy just how much she didn't hold that baseball bat in any threatening way.
You like how she holds it like a twirling baton?
Yeah. Or like a feather quill.
She was getting ready to bunt.
That makes more sense.
Anyway, yeah, basically, what I'm looking for is in that scene, for her to actually beat the hell out of Jack, but then take just a couple steps back from that. So my pick for Wendy is Leslie Mann.
Ooh. I like that.
Yeah, I think that she's just played a lot of characters that are headstrong, even if she hasn't done really any action films. I mean, like a Suburban Mom is kind of her wheelhouse, and this role really wouldn't be any different, but I think she's just a little bit tougher, and, well, she's got the eyes for a good horrified scream expression sort of thing. So I think two things, what I'm looking for, just hold the baseball bat and then give me a good horror scream, and I think she's got them both.
Yep, she's a good crier too. Like This Is 40. I don't know if you saw that, but just like, yeah, she runs the gamut of emotions in that, and she's great. And she is truly like one of the funniest women alive. She usually plays the other girl to like the Kristen Wiggs of the world, and I think that she can be as funny or funnier than they can, because she's just really talented and really beautiful and can play lots of different ages. And she's astoundingly talented. Yep.
Yeah, and she is hilariously funny. And I haven't seen her in a lot of drama, but I think she's definitely got the chops for it.
Yep, agreed.
Yeah,
isn't she perpetually Paul Rudd's wife?
Perpetually, yeah. Yes.
She's married to Judd Apatow, so she has done many Judd Apatow movies, and as has Paul Rudd. And This Is 40 and Knocked Up is in the same universe. So the characters from Knocked Up, then they go on to tell the story of Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann and them turning 40 in This Is 40. So it's the same characters. Okay. Yep.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I like how I describe that as the same universe. It works, but it's, you know, it's like X-Men. It's like in the Infinity Gauntlet. Yeah.
We better move on to Andy.
Indeed.
Hey. Sorry. I'm a little tired tonight.
Did your previous joke put you to sleep, Andy?
It was so bad. It was so bad. I picked my Wendy Torrance actress kind of based on who I picked for Jack Torrance, because what bugged me about the original casting between Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall is I couldn't see them as a couple. I just didn't buy that they were husband and wife. So that was my biggest hang up. I think that Shelley Duvall was fantastic and the just playing the horrified, freaked out, you know, like we said, the fight or flight adrenaline junkie that she ended up turning out to be. But I just didn't picture her and Jack Nicholson as spouses. So that largely influenced who my choice was. I chose Amy Adams. I think that
nice.
She is a very accomplished actor. There's no doubt about that. And I think that she has the emotional range to play the struggling, like the wife struggling to hold the family together, the completely freaked out. And I would like to think that she could hold a baseball bat a little bit more realistically as well.
I think so. I never saw Trouble with the Curve, but
oh, yeah, that was a baseball
movie.
It
gave that impression. Yeah.
So, like, I could see Amy Adams, had she been of the right age, playing in A League of Their Own.
Mm, yeah. You know?
Anyway, totally. Yep. She could be that kind
see?
Of like,
you know what I mean?
Sprite-y. Yep. 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 Absolutely.
Therefore, she's qualified to play.
Little did we know we'd go there for that, but that's pretty great.
So, but yeah, Amy Adams was my choice for the role of Wendy Torrance.
That's great. It seems like she's become more comfortable with her physicality, both in terms of like her kind of beauty and just being willing to flaunt it a little bit. And the physicality here would not necessarily be like the, you know, shaking it kind of thing, or it wouldn't be like the toughness that she showed in The Fighter, but it would be like somewhere in between. It would be kind of that that emotional perseverance of The Fighter, but, you know, being willing to stand up for herself
I hear what you're saying, and I would describe it as like, towards the end, I think this is what Shelley Duvall did, like the maternal instinct, the maternal protective instinct kicked in for her to overcome her fear. You know, like she knew that even though she was freaked out by what Jack was doing, she had to protect Danny and did that. And I could see Amy Adams doing that very well.
The quintessential scene for me for this character is when she is suspecting that something's going wrong. There's something not quite right. And she walks up to the typewriter and sees all of the pages with all work and no play make Jack a dull boy. And she's just reading like reams and reams of the same sentence over and over again. Just her facial expression as the camera kind of comes up from below and then the wide shots and everything, just her fully realizing that you are screwed. Like, he has gone off the deep end and we are in deep trouble now. Like, she just, without saying a word that entire time, you just realize that she now knows the depth of what is happening here. And it's not just he's depressed and he's in one of his, angry moods or whatever. No, he's lost it and we're trapped here now. Like, that's, it's just so perfect. And then when he says something and she just jumps and she's so startled, like it's fantastic.
Well, that scene while I was watching it, that was one of those where, like, had I a blanket, I would have like been holding it over my face, because that's an example to me of just great directing, because it's like with the soundtrack, with the camera angles, with the suspense in the scene, like I was just expecting Jack to just jump out from the shadows and just bury a knife into her back while she's reading all these pages, because the mood is so tense. And even though when he says something like, do you like it, honey? And he's a solid 20 feet away. But I think I screamed at the same time that Shelley Duvall screamed.
I cannot imagine seeing that in the theater for the first time. Like how that must have been.
Yep. So I have a business idea not a business idea, but just a website idea. So for you nerds out there, you can take this and run with it free of charge. So there's lorem ipsum, which is filler text for websites. So like if you are designing a website, you just put in like 500 words of lorem ipsum just to see what words would look like in your website, but it doesn't have to be specific words. So it's just Latin text. Well, I want to have The Shining lorem ipsum. So I think like just a series of all work and no play make Jack a dull boy. So somebody create a web tool called Shining Ipsum of just that phrase over and over and over again. So I think that's
the thing that really made that scene for me, is that there are so many pages that have different formatting of the way that he types it out.
Yeah.
Like it's an honest to God dialogue in his head, as though he's writing something out, but all he is typing is that. Yeah.
He's not bored. There's thought and calculation in all of it, and there's designs and patterns, and it just makes it. And then that slow, quiet, just screech of cellos and strings in the background. Oh, like it's just such a perfect scene.
Like I can imagine Kubrick having tricked one of his production assistants into getting so bored that they just started playing with the text formatting while their job was just to type out thousands of pages.
All the, I'm going to interrupt again. And according to the trivia on IMDb, which is infallible, that
on the internet,
So all of the scenes where Jack is supposedly typing, those are actually the sounds of the typist they hired to type out those pages because they wanted to make sure that the typing sounds were realistic, that he would, you know, he would be typing those words and this is what it would truly sound like.
So yep, I followed that. I listened to the characters and it was like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
You know, it was like all work and it was awesome.
Nerd.
Because I'm, yeah.
Yep.
Asperger's anyone? Yo.
But made it so scary.
Yeah, indeed. Yep. All right. So moving on. In the role of Wendy Torrance, originally played by Shelley Duvall, Jer chose Zoe Saldana. I chose Julianne Moore. Lee chose Evangeline Lilly. Mark chose Leslie Mann. And Andy chose Amy Adams. Man, those are all over the place in an awesome way. I love that so much. That's great. And it speaks volumes to the original performance, too. So now our last major character, that of Jack Torrance. Lee, tell us about Jack.
Yes, played by the irreplaceable Jack Nicholson in probably one of the more defining roles of his career. Simultaneously the main character and villain, Jack suffers a slow descent into madness while trying to enjoy the solitude. Eventually he succumbs to the psychological torture being visited upon him by perhaps supernatural forces. Not 100% sure, but I'm going with it.
Yep.
Andy touched on this in pre-production, where he said that Jack Nicholson looked crazy already in the beginning, and I agreed with that. I wanted to find someone who was maybe a little bit more normal and could contrast that with how nuts he looked in the end. So I went with James Badgedale. I don't know if anybody knows him, but he's been in a few supporting roles. He was in The Departed as one of the Boston PD detectives. He was in, he had a very brief role in the movie Flight with Denzel Washington. I don't know if you guys saw that one. He plays a cancer patient in that. And he was most notably in The Pacific, the 10-part HBO miniseries about the 1st Marine Division in World War II, and he played a writer by the name of Robert Leckie, and that's what I know him most from, and I've seen the spectrum of what he can do, because he's in almost every episode of that miniseries, but I think he's fantastic for this. I could see him being completely normal in the beginning and just an absolute nut job in the end. So,
yeah, James Badgedale. I like that rationale. That's good.
Thanks.
All of the everything that he's been in are things that I have wanted to see but haven't seen, so I'm gonna have to check him out.
Yeah, ditto. Exactly.
If you want to get a good idea for what he can do, watch The Pacific. It's worth watching anyway. But he's really good in it. He's kind of like Damian Lewis in Band of Brothers in a lot of ways. There's a lot of the stories that sort of revolve around him.
Can we get a ding? Because we've now had our requisite Band of Brothers and Sahara references.
Indeed. The quota has been met. Yes.
Yeah. I think we hit like as soon as I mentioned Scott Pilgrim.
Nice.
I think we hit the Band of Brothers quota 5 episodes ago. But
indeed. Now in this episode of Rememers, Mark.
Yeah. So, Mark, who do you got for this one?
All right, well, I'm on the same page where I was looking for somebody a little bit more normal. I think it was Jer who described Jack Nicholson's portrayal as being a crazy man trying to stay sane rather than a sane man slowly going crazy. And while that's really interesting, I kind of like seeing normal people go crazy. It's a hobby of mine.
As yeah. we all do, yes.
Yeah. We all need hobbies. So I picked Aaron Eckhart.
Ooh.
And,
oh, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. That's good. We know him from The Dark Knight as Harvey Dent / Two-Face. We know him from Olympus Has Fallen recently. A lot of other things. I really like him in Thank You for Smoking.
Yes. Absolutely.
He's very good in that.
But yeah, he's shown that he can be you know, really normal, really tender, and he can be absolutely menacing. And, well, hey, I mean, we know the story. We need somebody that gets to menacing eventually. And I like Aaron Eckhart for that.
Yep. Like The Dark Knight is a good indication of that, where he went, where he came from and where he ended up on that was pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I like that. Yeah.
I would almost want, I mean, if you're going to take that as a gauge, I mean, he kind of goes from heroic and, you know, this square jawed hero of the city to completely off his rocker crazy, which is, I mean, that was the whole point of it. It's very, you know, comic booky in the two sides of that. Yeah. But you would almost want that just muted to like what Kyle has described as the slow burn. You want that to just sort of trickle out and not just be like, I'm crazy now. Like you want it to just be more of a madness than a crazy, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, for starting at the beginning of the film, I mean, he's done lighthearted things. Like, he did a romantic comedy called No Reservations with Catherine Zeta-Jones. And, you know, in that one, he's, I'd say almost goofy, but, very, very lighthearted, just kind of a comic figure. And, you know, I could take that as a reference for him being, being a dad. And then we'll get him to Two-Face by the end of the movie as he goes crazy. But yeah. I think he's got everything in between. So. And yep. It's a role that would need to show it. So,
yep, I agree with that completely.
Yeah. All right, Kyle, how about you?
Yeah, so I kind of went with the not so crazy to start with, although I went with always unsettling. So I wanted him to not seem wacko, but I wanted you to feel ill at ease from the moment you saw him, which I think Nicholson did well, but I think he did it with like sort of that perma furrowed brow thing, you know, where it was just sort of like, I'm always really something. But you don't quite know what.
That just seems how he looks all the time.
Yeah, but I think that, I don't know. It's sort of like when your parents are like, hey, if you cross your eyes for that long, they'll stay that way. Like, I think basically every role that he did like that, they just sort of ended up that way. So,
and didn't he just come out of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest right before this movie?
Oh, really?
Yeah, that seems about right.
Yep. I think that might be right. And so he was already in that frame of, I'm going to go crazy in this movie.
That was actually one of Stephen King's criticisms of casting him.
Yep.
So
yeah, everybody was expecting him to be nuts.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So I wanted to not have crazy, but I definitely wanted unsettling. And so the actor that I went with is Joaquin Phoenix. Has a huge amount of range. He can be very charismatic. He can be soft, but what he's sort of been pigeonholed in a little bit of late is that kind of like crazy character, but one that you want to root for sort of at the same time. Like he did that sort of faux documentary that ended up being fake about himself that was just preposterous, but like, yeah. It basically made it like, I just love that he did it. I think that's awesome. But, you know, made it look like he had gone off the deep end, essentially. But it was just a performance piece, which good on him. I think that's kick ass. It made me think of Andy Kaufman, which is always a good thing. But and then, you know, something like The Master. I don't know if you guys saw that. But he in that was like, you know, he was off. He was crazy. But you kind of hope for him to come around. I think his face is amazingly expressive without him doing anything. And I think that him just sitting at a typewriter and typing, it wouldn't have that look of like, oh boy, it would just be like, okay, he's working, you know, like, so, but I think he can get there. I think he can be that overblown, scary, like legitimately freaky guy. And so, you know, that range is really what I was going for. This is totally separate, but have you guys seen the trailer for the movie coming out, the next Spike Jonze movie called Her?
No.
Okay. No. Go after we're done with this, go to trailers.apple.com. Don't do it now because we're on Skype and it will suck our bandwidth. But go to the trailers page and watch that. It's about a guy that basically has a relationship with a female AI. So it's like a guy having a relationship with Siri. and it sounds just preposterous. You watch the trailer, you're like, I'm all in. That it looks so good. And he's the main character in it. And it's the same kind of thing where he just like goes all over the place. But yeah, I think he's an astounding actor. I think he's one of the best actors that we have. And I think he can get pigeonholed in these crazy roles. And I just don't want for him to only have that. He just does it so well. You know? So yeah, so Joaquin Phoenix is my choice.
I did really, really like him as the emperor in Gladiator.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's if you're talking slow burn crazy, yeah. Just under the surface crazy, that's perfect.
Yeah, he was absolutely the best choice for somebody as totally nuts as Commodus.
Yep. Yeah, actually, that's a good analogy, yeah.
To call back to our One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest timeline, there it was actually 5 years earlier that they did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, so...
Wow. He was just flying very slowly, that's all.
So he was, I don't know if he was necessarily in that crazy sort of mind from that, unless he really gets into the character and really can't get out of the character.
Never quite left
him. I could see Nicholson doing that.
Yeah, it's true.
Totally. Andy, how about you? Who did you pick for Jack?
Like everyone else, I wanted someone who was a little less crazy at the beginning, but could be crazy at the end. I chose Carl Urban. Who some of us may know most recently and most well known as Bones in the Star Trek reboots, the J.J. Abrams Star Trek reboots. Mm-hmm. And he was also in The Two Towers and Return of the King, I believe. I forget his character's name. Is it
Aomer?
Aomer. One of the riders of Rohan. He definitely has action cred, and I think he's probably most well known for playing a physical type character, although I really enjoyed him as Bones. I thought he nodded a hat to the guy that originally played Bones.
DeForest Kelly.
Thank you.
Nice work, Mark.
Thank you. And his portrayal, but yeah, it still made it a fun modern twist on the character. But anyway, I think he seems like he'd be kind of a normal guy. I could see him as a writer. I also could see him with Amy Adams as a couple. That seems more realistic to me. But man, picturing Carl Urban swinging an axe through a door, I could see him doing it maybe in a little less of the wide-eyed crazy like Jack Nicholson did it, and more of just like the steely-eyed like Michael Douglas in Falling Down, like. Ooh.
Oh,
that
nice.
Kind of crazy, like completely no more fear, no consequences, no nothing. Just this is what I'm doing and whatever. So I don't know. I don't know if that's good or bad, but that's how I would see him playing it. So
yeah, I'm really impressed by him.
Yeah.
And I think that's an excellent pick.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I haven't seen it, but the Judge Dredd movie that came out in the last year or so,
the remake,
everybody
of that, one, yeah.
That I saw who saw it absolutely raved about it. It didn't do super well box office wise. It sort of had the curse of the terrible Sylvester Stallone one over it, but it was supposed to just be like incredibly good. And he plays Dredd in that. He plays Judge Dredd. So right. Yeah,
I'm gonna have to see that now.
Yeah, definitely. I'm gonna go add that to my queue. Yep. So cool. Good pick.
Thank you, Jer. Top that.
I will do my best. I picked somebody that I have liked for a while as an actor, and somebody who has not played a lot of villains. He generally plays the good guy. He has some Stephen King cred to him from The Stand. But I picked Gary Sinise.
Ooh.
I think that nice. He would have the everyman quality that we would be looking for at the beginning. You're wanting to root for him, but I think that he, and I'm going to pull back a ways to an earlier movie of his with Rene Russo and Mel Gibson, Ransom.
Oh yeah,
he plays mm-hmm. the kidnapper in that.
Yep.
And just he's plain old creepy in that movie, and I mean it's kind of a throwaway movie for the most part. It's not a intensely great movie by any means, but he does show that he's got some range in that, and in a lot of the things that he's done since then has shown that he's not just the chummy good guy, but even in is it CSI that he's in now, one of the CSIs. He's got an edge to him. He's not just the good natured infallible cowboy with the white hat. He's got some emotion and depth to him, and so I think that he would be a great pick in that he would get us rooting for him at the beginning, and then when we realize that he has either been crazy this entire time or his slow descent into that crazy, we'll be more attached to it because we were already bought in from the beginning that he was the good guy, even though we're going to know that he wasn't because we've all seen the movie before. But there's that attachment that then just gets severed when he just goes off the deep end and decides that it's time for him to kill his family. And so,
is it that time already?
Ding. So
time for your correction.
That's my pick. I have loved him for a long time. I think he's got a great range to him, and so that's my pick, Gary Sinise.
Yeah. I have to wonder if he's starting to feel a little bit old to do the dad of a young kid.
I think that's he could do the dad of a teenager, and yeah. I will counter that he is more everyman-ish than I think the role was originally written as in the book. You know, I mean, I think he could, like, one of the people I considered was Philip Seymour Hoffman as kind of like a little bit more schlubby, but no less that's terrifying in his own way. Yeah. So like, Gary Sinise is more just like, he can be that normal guy that has that darkness to him. Yeah, totally. In him.
He's always Lieutenant Dan to me.
Yeah. I was going to say for his everyman persona, I was tagging Of Mice and Men, the reboot of that.
Yeah, that was a good one.
And then for when he loses it, Lieutenant Dan, when he's a drunk. So
Yeah.
There's some of that.
Even his role in Apollo 13, which was a little bit smaller, but
he did such a great job. He was my favorite part of that movie.
But I think that was another good one of not the raging explosion, but just like the seething, almost withdrawing kind of madness at the beginning, like when he decides to just drink himself into a stupor and whatnot.
Yep.
Good times. Right.
Good times. Those are great times. Drunk.
Good times. All right. So in the role of Jack Torrance, originally played by Jack Nicholson, Lee chose James Badge Dale. Mark chose Aaron Eckhart. I chose Joaquin Phoenix, Andy chose Carl Urban, and Jer chose Gary Sinise. I'm noticing that we're running down here on the clock. This is another long one. So we're going to do director here. We're going to talk a lot about the Kubrickness of this in part two. So we're just going to name the director who we think would do this movie justice in Stanley Kubrick's mind. You know what I mean? Like if Kubrick could pick somebody today, who would he pick or who would we want to pick to kind of to help honor that lineage? So let's not dwell upon this too much, knowing that that's going to come a lot in part two, but let's all talk about that. So Stanley Kubrick is known as one of the greatest film directors of all time. While he was by no means prolific, every movie that he made over his years in the business can be seen as a masterpiece of its particular genre, and that can absolutely be said for The Shining and psychological horror movies. He's been often imitated but never equaled. Trying to fill Stanley Kubrick's shoes is impossible. I'll just go out and say that. Like, nobody today can do what Kubrick did. I don't know if anybody ever will be able to, and that's okay, because that's what makes an auteur who they are, or a great visionary who they are.
Agreed.
But the director who I thought could capture that level of brilliance, or the type of movie that The Shining kind of deserves to be, which is tight and interesting, but all over the gamut emotionally, is Paul Thomas Anderson. I think he is, without saying he's Kubrickian, he is as close to a Kubrick as we have as a filmmaker. He is incredibly talented. His camera work is astounding. He does so well with the camera, and I think that's in line with what Kubrick did in this in the original movie. He works with actors really well. He's not afraid to shy away, or he does not shy away from emotion at all, and I think this movie would need that. So yeah, so Paul Thomas Anderson was my choice. You would know him of Boogie Nights, Magnolia, Punch Drunk Love, and The Master fame.
There Will Be Blood.
There Will Be Blood. Yep.
That's that one scene in that movie where the during the sermon at the church, where he slowly pans the camera in through the doorway. It's brilliant.
He's a master. I mean, I don't use that term lightly, but he's a master filmmaker, and he is just not afraid to show it too. He's not showy. He almost could be, but then the movies are so good and the emotional core is there that the filmmaking just sits on top of that in a really good way. So yeah. Yep. Andy, how about you? Who did you pick?
I chose Jean-Pierre Jeunet, I'm not sure how to say his last name.
Jeunet.
You probably know his work in Amelie, possibly A Very Long Engagement or Delicatessen. He has a very distinct visual style. And I wouldn't want him to attempt to ape Kubrick. I don't think that, as you said, Kyle, that would just be silly. But I chose him because I love his visual style. I think he can alter it to match the mood of the film and still make it work and still make it look like it's his movie. But he's also got, I was just thinking of when you were talking about these long camera shots, there's a couple in Amelie specifically that have these very complex but long crane shots. They're not Steadicam shots, but they're crane shots. But they almost, if you think about where the camera goes and follow it, it's almost like it's this long serpent that's backing out, you know, out of a hole and then twisting and rising and moving and things like that, that are just beautiful and brilliant shots. So Jean-Pierre Jeunet is my choice for this one.
Excellent. Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't know that it's a great choice, but I would totally see it, you know? So maybe that makes it a great choice. I don't know. Like I would totally see that Shining just for the, like, what in the hell is he going to do factor?
Yeah, I guess.
Which is great.
Looking at like a very long engagement, that's a wonderful movie, but it's not a pleasant movie. I mean, or I should say, like, compared to Amelie, for example. Amelie's very uplifting, very warm, very fun, but A Very Long Engagement has some very, very dark pieces to it. So I don't want people to hear his name and think, oh, he's just gonna make things all bright colors and, you know, wistfulness, because I don't think he would.
Yeah, well, maybe a good reference is Alien Resurrection, the fourth movie in the Alien series.
Oh yeah,
which he directed, where for three movies the Alien was very straight ahead, just dark and sometimes action-packed, but a more suspenseful, very scary sci-fi movie. And then he comes along for the fourth movie, and it's almost whimsical at the same time as it's scary. I mean, it's so twisted.
Mark, are you helping my argument here? Or are you?
I don't think he is.
I think the reference of the movie is not helping, but the description is. I agree. Yeah. Yep.
A whimsical version of The Shining.
Yeah. Well, just the sort of cleverness that he brought to something that was very scary and very dark was excellent. That's what I'm saying.
Thank you. So,
you're welcome.
Mark, now it's our turn.
Well, my director of choice is Alfonso Cuarón.
Oh, man.
We would know him from having directed such films as Children of Men, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, Itu Mamba Tambien, if that's your sort of thing.
As it should be. Yes.
But yeah, I just love the camera work. I love the sort of air and just atmosphere that he brings to, I guess, to his set. I mean, you really get an environmental feel for in the work that he does. But then also, we've been talking about the long camera shots. That's something that I just adore. And he really does that well. I mean, I think of this one scene from Children of Men where it's a car chase scene, but the heroes are kind of escaping from the villains in a car that won't start. And so they kind of coast it down a hill, and Clive Owen's character has to push it for half the scene, and it's very kind of grinding and awkward, and a lot of it is just one long shot, but it's absolutely stunning. It's so captivating.
It is, and the camera work inside the car is especially extraordinary, given the challenges of filming that. Imagine filming a captivating scene inside your car, and that's what they did. I mean, they had to, like, you know, build out this giant car to make it work, but yeah, that is extraordinary. He has, like, balls. I there's just no better word to say it as a filmmaker. Like he's like, well, I'm gonna do a 17 minute take. Okay. Like, he just does it and it works and it never feels gimmicky. Like, you don't realize it until afterwards. You're like, holy crap, that was one shot. But he also does performances really well. He ekes out really good performances from his actors and makes really good casting choices.
Yeah.
And he worked with Julianne Moore in Children of Men, I might say.
Yeah. One of the big reasons I picked him is because the environmental sort of aspect. I mean, the things that he did with Hogwarts in the Harry Potter film, you really, really got this expansive feel from, in a way that other directors didn't do it with the other Harry Potter movies. And that's something that that we note about Kubrick's work with the Overlook Hotel, is that you never quite get the same view of one room, and you get so many different experiences of different places in the hotel. It just seems enormous, and like you could very easily get lost in it. I think Cuarón would do an excellent job in that setting.
Yep, that's a good reference point. I like that.
All right, let's move on to Jer.
I had it down to two, and I chose David Fincher.
Ooh. Nice.
He has done The Game, Seven, Panic Room, Lords of Dogtown, I think was something of his. But the film that has always stuck with me as just being just a beautifully shot and directed film is Zodiac.
Yeah.
It in some ways has some Kubrickian, and yes, I'm creating adjectives around Stanley Kubrick's name, qualities to it. And just the way that his cinematographic, I'm not going to say that again. the way that he creates a scene and shoots it, it's just beautiful to watch. Even if it's just a grisly scene, he just does. It's different from Stanley Kubrick. He doesn't have some of the same qualities, but I think that it would feel like a different film. But I think it would have the same qualities overall, even if it looked different than Kubrick's version.
He reminds me of Stanley Kubrick in that he never makes the same movie twice.
It's true. Yeah, there's, yep.
And he can be overly controlling in a way that in the moment is frustrating as hell, but in the end result, everyone's like, you know what? That deserved it. And so he is notoriously rough on actors and does tons of takes. And he also is masterful with the camera. So, yep, there's some great parallels there.
Yeah, I like him a lot, and I think the reason I like him is because he reminds me of Stanley Kubrick in his movies. And he mixes the actors, the environment, the sound, the lighting, like all of that stuff just goes into making a scene what he wants it, making us feel what he wants us to feel in it. And if that's confusion, if that's, you know, fear, whatever it might be, he does a great job of masterfully directing, because that's what he does. You know, everything, all the elements together.
Yep, good pick.
I loved his version of Madonna's "Express Yourself" video.
Nice. That's reaching. That's reaching back. Much,
yeah. And then he recently has done the. I thought this is what you're going to say, the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo movies.
Yeah, that was good too.
Yeah, I heard of that.
Not my favorite, but they were good. Oh, sorry. You're waiting for me to pass the baton.
Yeah.
So we're to Lee now. Lee, who did you pick for the director of The Shining?
I picked Michael Mann. And nice. Mostly because of his ability to almost make you forget that you're watching a movie and that you're more or less eavesdropping on these people's lives. And it's just his style. And I love it. It's when you see the movie Heat or The Insider, you definitely get that feeling that, you know, you're seeing things that maybe should be private, that, you know, you're eavesdropping on them. I just think that's a really terrific style and an unbelievable talent that he has for directing.
That is maybe the best encapsulation of a director that I've ever heard. Well played. That was
Thank
awesome.
Thank you.
And I think it would be really interesting in this particular instance too. So yeah, right on.
Thank you.
All right. So those were our director choices. I went with Paul Thomas Anderson. Andy went with Jean-Pierre Jeunet. Mark went with Alfonso Cuarón. Jer went with David Fincher. And Lee went with Michael Mann. Now to wrap up this marathon first episode here, we're going to do three real quick lightning round minor characters. The first of that is Delbert Grady. Delbert Grady is a lot of things to a lot of people. A butler to partygoers, a devoted husband, dad, and murderer to his wife and young girls, and a firm but gentle spirit guide to the increasingly unhinged Jack Torrance. Delbert Grady first gets mentioned early in the movie as the person who murders his whole family here. And so it's sort of said like, well, we sort of are obliged to tell you, Jack Torrance, that there was a huge murder here and it's no big deal, but just, you know, be aware of that. And then he shows up later in the scene where there's a ball going on, whether it's in Jack's mind or whether this is some sort of supernatural force. He spills something on Jack and then they have this big long dialogue bit in a bathroom where he cleans him off as the butler. And he basically says that you've always been here, Jack, that you've always been at the Overlook. And he It's a very interesting performance by Philip Stone is the original actor. You know, nothing of note other than he is very, very proper. And he says, sir, both more often and better than any actor maybe I've ever seen. So I wanted somebody that had that stalwartness and that properness. But I wanted somebody that was a little younger. His age felt awkward to me. It felt a little old maybe. So I went with Ralph Fiennes. I think he has a presence that would just be scary in that role where, you know, you can see him as a butler, but then when he kind of turns in the bathroom where he stops cleaning him off and he basically starts saying, like, you know, yes, I did do this, and you know, you were going to do the same, you were going to take care of this situation, you know, I mean, it's just like I just get shivers thinking about that. So so for Delbert Grady I went with Ralph Fiennes. How about Stuart Altman, Jer, who did you pick for that?
Well, as one little last mention of the Gradys, Delbert Grady, the butler, is different than Charles Grady, who is the old caretaker who murdered his family.
Oh. There are
two different Gradys.
Oh, I'm sorry. I blew that.
No, that's a common misconception and something that people argue about all the time. Are they the same person, just like Jack is the Jack from the painting in 1921 and now he's Jack again? Like, is this another person who just belongs to the hotel in all these different iterations?
If that's a mistake, wasn't it the same mistake that Jack actually makes talking to Delbert in the bathroom?
Yeah, he says that to them directly. You chopped him up in little bits.
And he doesn't know what he's talking about. Just a aside, we can talk more about that in the second episode. I went, the character of Stuart Altman is another pretty minor role. He is the guy that introduces Jack and explains the situation, what he's going to be doing, takes him on the tour of the hotel. So we first get to see the kind of the expansiveness of it and the creepiness of it, and then tells him about the history and of the caretaking role and the sordid past. And in some conspiracy circles, people believe that he represents America. And that's why he, quote unquote, conspiracy theory quotes, looks like JFK. And so going along with that, I chose Rob Lowe to play the Stuart Altman character.
Rob Lowe looks like America.
He looks like America.
That's right. I can't argue there.
Put him in kind of a tacky sort of suit jacket and corduroy pants or something, and you know, just make him very schmoozy and lots of handshakes and walking around and showing him all of the different places that all the horrible things are about to happen in the, you know, the next few weeks. And I think that he would simultaneously put you at ease and also like make you really uncomfortable watching what's going to happen next. Rob Lowe.
I like it. Yep. Good one. Rob Lowe is America. That's going to be the name of his memoir 10 years down the road. For Lloyd the bartender, Andy, who did you pick for Lloyd?
Lloyd the bartender, he offers Jack wisdom, bourbon,
mostly those two things.
Just try that again. Lloyd the bartender appears in the gold room and offers Jack essentially bourbon and wisdom. He's also incapable of blinking, moving his neck, or being a real person who is not a ghost / hallucination / visible sign of impending insanity. I originally was going to go with Crispin Glover for this role.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
But I didn't. He's my understudy for this role. Because I swung for the fences, and for this role, I picked Daniel Day-Lewis.
Nice. Wow.
Yep, I went there.
Wow. Home run, indeed.
You have convinced me.
Yeah, and I challenge any of you to tell me that Daniel Day-Lewis cannot play a certain role. Specifically, I just think that having him, I mean, if we were to remake this movie and have him kind of, like as we said before in certain other films, be like an uncredited cameo would be a neat little thing for the audience. But really, I could see him kind of doing that same staring straight ahead, not changing his facial expression, being civil to the point of where it always looks like what Lloyd the bartender was speaking through gritted teeth to, you know, to not insult the patron is kind of how I interpreted it. But really, Daniel Day-Lewis, come on. Why haven't we picked him for everything ever?
It's true.
That's Andy, when you said that you were going to swing for the fences this afternoon or yesterday, I thought in my mind that you had picked Hank Azaria.
Ooh, that'd be good too. Yeah.
Hey, Alma.
Oh, hey, Alma. Wow.
Oh, goodness. All right.
Hank Azaria was busy. I couldn't get him, so I had to go with Daniel Day-Lewis instead.
It's the same thing.
Daniel Day-Lewis is a respectable second choice for that. That's perfectly fair. All right. So that was our recasting, about 6 hours worth, which
Man, that
is good.
Was long. It's
thorough but enjoyable. So if you want to find out more information about this podcast or any others on the Math is Hard Network, check us out at mathishard.net. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at username mathishardnet. Part two of our discussion of The Shining will be released on September 23rd, where we will be discussing our plot and filmmaking changes that we would make to the movie as well. So, gentlemen, as always, thanks for your time and your picks. This is always a wonderful time, and I appreciate hanging out with you. Gentlemen, until next time, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.